all on you.
Let Us Put a Spell on You, Saturday, August 29th, from 2 p.m. until 5 p.m., with the music and revolutionary life of Miss Nina Simone, right here on 90.7 FM, KBOO.
I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Hubert Selper, who's an acclaimed filmmaker whose earlier film, Darwin's Nightmare, earned him an Academy Award nomination for Best Documentary. He is the director, writer, and cinematographer of the award-winning documentary Just Out, We Come as Friends, which is now playing in New York, Los Angeles, Washington, D.C., and next week will be in Chicago and San Francisco. Welcome to Background Briefing, Hubert Selper.
Hi, Ian.
And your film is a devastatingly powerful film, and it, of course, it's your own personal journey via this little homemade silver plane that you call a lawnmower with wings, named Sputnik. But you take us into the continent of Africa, and particularly the most tortured, perhaps, not that there aren't other atrocities going on across Africa, but South Sudan is particularly tragic because it's the world's newest country, had so much promise, and it's descended into a vicious civil war between two warlords. But it's really a journey into how colonialism, globalism, and corruption have devastated so much of Africa. But what I found extraordinary about it is that it feels like it's the ground truth. You know, you're really hearing from Africans how they feel about the West, and particularly us, the Europeans, and what we've done to their continent. And it seems to me that so much of what goes on, you know, our criticisms of Africa and its terrible governance misses the point, because these Africans that you have in your film, they know all that. They know they're led by criminals and warlords and murderers and thieves. But they also know that these are the very people that Western multinational companies prefer to deal with.
Yes, Ian. Well, you're assuming things better than I guess. It takes me 6 years to make a movie in this case, and I guess I'm better in images than in words. But We Come as Friends is an attempt of a psychoanalysis of the pathology I call it, of colonialism and globalism and slave trade, by the way, because these three waves of history were three kind of similar phases of history. As history never repeats itself, history doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes, as says Mark Twain, and therefore the three waves of humiliation between Europe, which is my continent, and Africa were exactly slavery, globalism, slavery, colonization, and globalism. And this film, We Come as Friends, is an attempt to analyze or to understand a bit better in this context of today's Sudan, because Sudan has a big history in the colonial context. It has been kind of the backyard of the Egyptian Empire, and then the Greeks and the Romans and the Ottomans and the Arabs and later the Brits and the French and today the Chinese and the Americans, China and USA. So every empire kind of does essentially the same. They all say we come as friends, and they come and take as much as they can in resources and human resources. And in our case, of course, it's mostly oil. You know, in South Sudan, the war which is going on now, which is a terrifying war between brothers, so to say, civil war in South Sudan, is which cut through tribal lines. It could be tribal lines or religious lines or national lines. It doesn't really matter. Essentially, people are going after each other for something that they don't profit from, which is a resource that someone else in the world, let's say us in the West or us in China, need to run the machine of industrialization. So it's an old story, new, and you know, we come as friends is just a very old story told in a new way, I guess.
Well, of course, what's even more tragic in that context, Hubert Sapper, is that this country has been devastated by a civil war. Hundreds of thousands have been killed. Half the population is starving. Billions of dollars of foreign aid have been stolen. But all the while, the oil keeps pumping, and the Chinese and the U.S. companies are making money. So that's the part that's extraordinary. The country gets destroyed, but the oil keeps flowing.
Yeah, which it is the absolute, you know, peak of perversion when you think of it. You know, the oil in many places of the world, but especially in the center of Africa, is the cause of conflict, but it's also fueling the conflict because it's kind of financing these wars. And ironically, the oil is also attracting, of course, directly and indirectly, humanitarian aid, because there is conflict and because people die, we from the West have to send our doctors, we have to send our UN peacekeeping missions, and we have to send our missionaries, by the way, who are also doing their share by bringing the word of Jesus, so to say.
Yeah, well, in this case, in your film, the word of Jesus comes via a solar-powered Bible.
Yeah, I mean, when you think of it, the problem that some of the missionaries have, that they want so bad to spread the word of God to people who don't know how to read and write, so they invented this thing called the solar-powered Bible. And the interesting tiny sub-story I'm going to tell you now, this is one of the things that I was, which are not in the film, but I was completely amazed about, is that the locals, the tribes people in the center of Africa, usually don't believe the story of someone coming and say there was a guy called Jesus, he died and then he resurrected, and they go like, yeah, we don't buy it. And then the missionaries, in kind of lack of argumentations, a lot of times they have little video recorders or screeners, and they show films with Jesus in it, you know, Mel Gibson or whoever, and this is serving as proof that Jesus has lived and has resurrected, and the locals take it as a proof, and then they start being believers. You know, that's kind of a one of these stories.
It was particularly the heart-wrenching and very deeply upsetting was when these American missionaries, who are all from sort of Texas and really are more about American values than Christian values, but they go out and force these young kids who grow up essentially naked in the Garden of Eden, if you will, force them to put on socks and sandals, and the little kid's bawling his eyes out because he's not used to having this weird stuff on his feet. And then the missionary's wife, you know, insists that the little kid does a dance with his new... and he's just bawling his eyes out. It just seemed to be encapsulated so much of this imposition, basically a little bit of Texas being transplanted into the heart of Africa.
Yeah, the interesting thing is that this is one of the scenes of the film in We Come as Friends. It's a very simple scene. It's one of those situations where missionaries are doing what they do, you know, they spread the word of God and they give clothes to people who are naked, so to say, or literally naked, and to children in this case. And it is one of these very simple moments in reality, which I saw while shooting We Come as Friends. And it's yet in the film, something clicks in the spectator's head, and something is like a crazy kind of shortcut. And we suddenly, this whole legacy of colonialism opens up. You know, it's similar to another scene when the U.S. ambassador is opening an electric power station and claims to bring literally and figuratively light to the locals. And it's just these little words are containing so much you know, load from, and they're so heavy, which when you put them in a context, I don't know how to say.
Yeah, they're heavy with irony and hypocrisy. Particularly the ambassadors, this most fatuous speech, let there be light, and then they turn on this diesel generator, and this black smoke belches out. And again, let me remind the audience, if I may, I'm speaking with Hubert Sapper, an acclaimed filmmaker whose earlier film, Darwin's Nightmare, earned him an Academy Award nomination for Best Feature Documentary. He is the director, writer, and cinematographer of the new award-winning documentary just out, We Come as Friends, which is now playing in New York, Los Angeles, Washington, D.C., and next week will be in Chicago and San Francisco. And this is a film that takes you into the heart of Africa, where you learn from the Africans themselves how they have this deep historical memory, going back to slavery through colonialism and now through globalism, where you have both Chinese and American multinational oil companies in particular pumping oil, while all around them is death and destruction as this civil war continues. By the way, just in terms of the news, last Wednesday, South Sudan's President Salva Kiir told the U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry that he does intend to sign this peace deal that had expired. But obviously, he's a despicable individual, surely, Kiir. I mean, here he is following in the legacy of a real hero, John Garang, and him and his vice president couldn't get on, so they had a civil war, and hundreds of thousands have died, and all this looting has gone on, all this money and hope has been totally blown. And yet, I guess, somehow or other, you can't get rid of this guy, right? He and the other guy will never be tried for war crimes, as opposed to Bashir in the north, who's indicted by the International Criminal Court.
Yeah. Well, it is so terribly complicated, this with these alliances and stuff. But what it comes down to is that what you said is that the problem of these people in the center of Africa is that they are living on top of hundreds of billions of dollars worth of oil and gold and uranium and you name it. And once this is a case, this place becomes the collision line between the big powers. It is as simple as that, and people on the spot are always paying. They're never really profiting from it, except a few, you know, as you said, warlords and politicians. And in this case, in the Sudan, is also very interesting, is that this very place where the war is now going on, and it is basically on the line on the Nile. This is the place where the British and the French were colliding exactly 100 years ago. The British wanted to own the Nile, the axis of the Nile towards the Cape, and the French were dreaming of this big colonial entity from the Atlantic to the Indian Ocean, and their interests crossed, and this led almost to World War One. Actually, it was 10 or something years before the actual World War One. But now the And then ultimately the French had to leave, and the British won and colonized the Sudan. But today it is the same story over, only there are new players. Now it's China and America, and they're colliding on the very same place. It's a very spooky story, actually. And this premise of the repetition of history, or the line of Mark Twain said, history doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes. Right. The premise of this movie, We Come as Friends.
Well, the United Nations Security Council have at least imposed sanctions in July on six generals from these rival factions, and their assets are frozen, and they're going to be facing travel bans. But Salva Kiir, I think he has about 300 plus generals. I mean, that's where all the money seems to go. But what's interesting here in terms of China, and in your film, you really do spend a lot of time with these Chinese oil workers. You seem to have tremendous access, and they're very casual. And they do put forth their different version of colonialism. They say, well, you, the Westerners, have done all these terrible things in the name of colonialism, and you want to impose everything on these people, but we just want their oil. just want to take their energy, and that's all there is to it. But the Chinese have actually deployed an infantry battalion to the United Nations peacekeeping mission in that country. And that's the first time that a battalion of Chinese troops have been deployed by the United Nations. Why can't the United Nations do anything? I mean, you show them in the film, they're just lounging around pools having a good time.
Well, you know, it's in a way it's easy to kind of hit on the UN because it's a lot of cases the UN are basically the only people, the only kind of representatives of our side of the world in certain places, and the UN are also going to places where there's conflict and therefore there's always a problematic situation. But the peacekeepers, I don't know what the peacekeepers can do. I mean, what I understood, they're keeping peace around the peace camps, and in the situation of the civil war in the south of Sudan now, actually the people who are afraid of being, you know, killed on tribal bases, they're running into these UN peace camps. And but what it comes down to, ultimately, when you see it from the perspective of the Sudanese, let's say, the delegation of the UN is just another set of people from the outside, and who are driving around with 4x4 cars, and who ultimately, in the eyes of the Sudanese, it doesn't make much of a difference if it's missionaries or Chinese oilmen or UN peacekeepers. It's just foreigners with white cars, 4x4 cars, who are living in a very different kind of life, who earn like 180 times more than any local. And it's not the fault of the UN. It's like the systemic problem. It's like we humans have nothing better to offer than what we offer, and this is as good as it can get, I guess, and with all its problems and with all its kind of also colonial heritage. And the camps of the UN also look like basically colonial camps, you know, but it's despite the UN. So I don't know. I'm a filmmaker and not a policymaker. It's hard to say what should be and what should not be, but I can at least do one thing is in 6 years of making a film, sharing questions which we wouldn't share maybe if it weren't through a film in this case, and they're very complicated questions. And but also, just to wrap this up, We Come as Friends is a movie, and a movie is something that moves you, that brings you into places and situations and feelings that you wouldn't have expected. It's also a movie that can make you laugh and that can take you out of your comfort zone of your thinking, and it is a passionate experience. I have to insist in that. It's not I didn't spend 6 years of my life to depress everyone and to tell my viewers in the cinema how bad everything goes and there's no way out. I think there are many ways out, but we have to get our brains together and find ways out, together. It's not, the solution is not in my movie.
Well, but that's what's so powerful about it, that you absorb so much truth through these images and these extraordinary people. And a lot of it is heartbreaking and some of it's surreal. And just towards the end, you've got these sound bites of Hillary Clinton, who's now running for president. She was then Secretary of State, saying that more and more of the world will look to Africa to be its breadbasket, and she hoped that Africans would be the beneficiaries of this. And we know that there's a huge land grab going on in South Sudan, some of the last huge tracts of land left on the planet. And in the film, you have this sequence with this African, I guess he's a tribal chief, and he's got this piece of paper, and he can't believe it. He said, I've lost my land. It's my land, and this piece of paper says I don't own it anymore. I've been here for forever. And, when he's studying the document under, a little flashlight, and it's the address for the people who own the land is in some industrial park in Dallas, Texas. Some corporation suddenly owns a whole chunk of this guy's tribal land. So what's going on in that regard?
Well, the legacy of colonialism is a legacy of land grabbing. That is per definition. I mean, we're in America, and we, the Europeans, came to this part of the world to take over and to sign off. I mean, Manhattan was signed off for a couple of guilders to to a Dutch businessman, and we all know these stories. You know, in the more recent history, in the center of Africa, the famous explorer Morton Stanley went to the Congo in the mandate of the King Leopold of Belgium, and made people sign off their land, forced or not forced. Sometimes they were the hands of the tribal leaders would be led by soldiers from the King Leopold to sign the land off. And now, as a filmmaker, you kind of know all these things, and you kind of track down how it's possible and how where it comes from. And some moments, you kind of see history unfolding in front of your eyes, and you see more than you would ever have wished for, and more that you would actually have wanted, you know. And in this case, the scene you're describing is literally the moment of truth and the moment of the end, I would say, of cultures and the end of the identity of whole peoples. And so with one, you know, signature, this old man in this case has signed off his land, kind of unknowingly or forced somehow, and he had spent his whole life fighting for his land against the Muslim invasion, by the way. I mean, which was also a form of colonialism in this case in southern Sudan. So he had fought and with his children, and he lost many members of the family to fight the Islamic aggression. And then when this war is over, he loses everything he had with one signature, which is a fantastic and devastating little example. But it's just one of these examples. It's just one of these scenes that are, yeah.
One of many, many scenes that are just extraordinary, and I can't recommend the film anymore. And I thank you very much for joining us here today, Hubert Sapper.
Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Hubert Sapper, who's an acclaimed filmmaker whose earlier film, Darwin's Nightmare, earned him an Academy Award nomination for Best Documentary Feature. He is the director, writer, and cinematographer of the award-winning documentary Just Out, We Come as Friends, now playing in New York, Los Angeles, Washington, D.C., and next week in Chicago and San Francisco.
Is California headed for a permanent drought? A new study says yes. That and other stories for the week ending August 23rd, 2015. I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin. And it's This Week in Water.
First, the good news for California. It's looking more likely that El Niño will bring needed moisture this winter. Now the bad news. Even if these storms are gushers, it won't necessarily mean more water.
Why? Because according to a new study, global warming is intensifying rates of evaporation. So even when it does rain or snow, higher temperatures are sucking moisture stored in plants and soil right into the air.
We and ecosystems are sharing our water resources with an increasingly greedy atmosphere.
That's Park Williams. He's a bioclimatologist at Columbia University's Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory and lead author of the study.
So we already know that as you warm air, then that air becomes more able to extract water from soils. And so in a warmer year, if there's also a drought, meaning there is lower than average precipitation, then the warmer air is going to make the drought worse. It basically makes every raindrop or snowflake that fell less valuable.
Williams and his team analyzed data from 1901 to 2014 and found that average temperatures have been creeping up about 2.5 degrees over a 114-year period, in step with rising fossil fuel emissions.
Those warmer temperatures were gradually removing moisture off California's surface, and it will have to rain more to make up the difference.
During an average year now, the state would need an average of 3.5 additional inches of precipitation in order to make up for the difference that warming is causing.
Unfortunately, the data show that rainfall trends aren't increasing, so those inches, they're not coming.
The researchers conclude that within a few decades, evaporation will overpower any increase in rain, and California will be more or less in a state of permanent drought.
What do you do with 300 tons of poop and pee that comes from animal farming? That's the amount of waste that's produced every year from raising pigs, poultry, and cattle here in the U.S.
And controversy over the effects of waste disposal methods is flaring up again due to the EPA's lack of action in issuing regulations for both air and water quality.
In one North Carolina county where there are 2 million pigs and only 60,000 people, the waste from hog farms is liquefied and sprayed onto adjacent crops as fertilizer.
But according to some like Waterkeeper Alliance and a professor at the University of North Carolina at Wilmington, this practice nurtures algal blooms that choke off rivers from oxygen and pollute other waterways.
Hog farms are disproportionately located in areas where people of color live in large numbers. Others note that the practice is causing headaches and asthma in children.
Early on, the Obama administration had promised to issue regulations about water and air quality around industrial food production.
But last month, EPA said in court that it wouldn't change the regulations, and according to Bloomberg, inspections and fines of feedlots dropped to a 7-year low last year.
Much of the focus on the Colorado River in the last couple of weeks has been on a spill of heavy metal-laced mining water into its tributaries.
But last week, a report was published showing that the river faces additional problems.
A study led by the U.S. Geological Survey found that levels of mercury and selenium in the Colorado River regularly exceed risk thresholds for fish and wildlife.
The study reports that the mercury gets into the food chain mostly from the air, much of it coming from outside the U.S. Selenium is probably transported from agricultural runoff.
In other news about water contamination, last week a report came out that shows an industrial chemical that was used to make Teflon persists in drinking water and may be more harmful than thought.
The chemical, which goes by the acronym PFOA, doesn't break down when it gets into the environment.
The study finds that drinking water of over 6.5 million Americans is contaminated with it. Some samples ranged between 5 and 175 times the level considered safe by this new research.
The study, published by the Environmental Working Group, states that people in the Mid-Ohio River Valley may be consuming unsafe amounts of PFOA every time they drink a glass of water.
The authors of the study note that the EPA has not set a maximum level for the chemical in drinking water, but has issued a health advisory that is hundreds or thousands of times too weak to fully protect human health with an adequate margin of safety.
The results show that outside the Mid-Ohio River Valley, New Jersey and California have the most widespread PFOA contamination.
Seems it never.
This Week in Water is a production of H2O Radio and is sponsored by Colorado WaterWise. Learn more at coloradowaterwise.org.
Twist, they do the tango inside me. Some vote yes and some vote no, and not because I tell them so. With all my fibers, I don't strain towards any one particular gain. Please, my fibers. Reunite, you all are me, and that's in spite. If I could only find a comb Then deep within me I would run and run it through my mixed up self and leave my tangles on the shelf. With scissors sharp, grow wings and learn to play the harp. With good intentions and shampoo, imagine what then I could do. All my fibers don't agree. They do the twist, they do the tango inside me. Some vote yes and some vote no, and not because I tell them so. All my fibers tried and true, I got the knot, so what can I do?
Dear KBOO listeners, I have one simple question for you. What is your favorite Hank Williams song? We are dedicating our September 12th Swingin' Country program to the music of Hank Williams, and we would like your input. We are calling it All Things Hank Consider, just to annoy the good people at National Public Radio. So please email us at program@kboo.org and tell us your favorite song by Hank Williams or your favorite song about Hank Williams, and we will play it on the September 12th Swingin' Country show right here on your community radio station. Once again, that email is program@kboo.org. So tune in September 12th at 6 a.m. as we solemnly pledge to play Hank, all Hank, and nothing but Hank. So help me God.
Alone and forsaken by fate and by man. Oh, Lord, if you hear me, please hold my hand.